We have before you today, and in the order in which they're going to speak, Sarah Nelson Palmeyer, who's on my extreme left, Jan Orell, who is next to me on my left. We have Martin Muller, who is on my immediate right, and Steve DeGrucci, who is on my extreme right. And we'll sort of take turns here, kind of summarize what we've been up to, or how we stayed out of jail, or how we got in, and also how we got out. Obviously, those of us who were in jail got out. I won't ask these whether they're on probation or not, but we're going to cover the world, or a good part of it, from India. I might even talk about her hometown. I know more about the jails in Jan's hometown in Western Australia than probably she does. She's managed to stay out of them. And Sarah's going to talk about Central America. And Martin will tell about his time, serving time in East Germany. And Steve will talk about South Africa. And then I'll have something to say about my incarceration. And with that, Sarah, you're on.
I'm basically going to talk about some of my experience connecting with jails in Nicaragua. I never was in jail or prison in Nicaragua except to visit, I'm glad to say. but I have visited quite a few prisons there, and I've studied the prison system, talking to people in the human rights organizations, the International Red Cross there, and also reading a lot of reports about the prisons in America's Watch, which is an international human rights organization that watches over human rights concerns in all the Americas, North and South. Just to preface, during the years before 1979, under the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua, there were a few jails and prisons, which you could say, well, that's good, that's something to be proud of. But on the other hand, there were a few jails and prisons because most people didn't stay in the prisons. Typically, people were killed that were taken as prisoners. And so there wasn't a lot of room necessary because you don't keep bodies very long. Since 1979, however, when the new government took over, some people call it the Sandinista government. I refer to it as the Nicaraguan government because it's not just Sandinistas in power, but a lot of other people as well. But there have been a lot of new prisons built, and there are more prisoners. There are about 9,000 prisoners in Nicaragua. But there is no death. There is no killing of prisoners as there was before. The death penalty has been ended since 1979. No one is punished by death. And there's also much, much less torture, especially according to the America's Watch and the International Red Cross, than there was previously in Nicaragua, and also than there is in the other Central American countries. And there are various reasons for imprisonment in Nicaragua, as in other countries, I imagine, but other people will talk about that. The first reason are typical crimes, such as the ones that we think about: theft, assault, rape, battery, those sorts of things. People get picked up, accused, go to court, convicted, and sent to prison. And that goes on all the time. Now, in a country such as Nicaragua, a country at war, there are also other reasons why people are imprisoned. And the other two that I mentioned, one are war crimes, and both those are both crimes that were committed by persons before 1979 during the dictatorship years. There was a National Guard in Nicaragua that was very corrupt and did a lot of assassinations among civilians. And so some of those people were caught after 1979, after the new government took over, and tried and sent to prison because of their because of what they had done during those years of the Somoza dictatorship. The maximum sentence, if I didn't say it before, is 30 years for anybody. The people who committed war crimes, people who maybe have killed people for other reasons outside of war, et cetera, but 30 years is the maximum sentence. And most of those people that are in prison for war crimes are in for 30 years. Now also, there are some people who have been accused and convicted of war crimes since 1979, and those are the ones that especially are fighting with the counter-revolutionaries, the group that our government is funding. If those people are caught and tried, then usually they get 30 years, sometimes less than that, depending on the level of their crime. If they killed people while they were in the counter-revolutionaries, then they get the maximum 30 years. If not, they get less time. Also, the third reason people would be in prison in Nicaragua is detention. And people are detained if they're suspected of, especially of aiding the counter-revolutionaries, and they're questioned. And this is the type of imprisonment that especially America's Watch and other human rights organizations are concerned about, because people are not accused of anything. They're just there under suspicion and they're questioned, and usually they're kept in not so nice conditions in order to get information out of them about the counter-revolutionary activities. So some of the criticisms of the prisons there are, one is that they're overcrowded, because now people are not killed and they're sent to prisons and jails. Some of the places used for prisons are not the typical prison structure. It was some old barn or something that was changed into a prison. And so the conditions are not so nice. And also what the Red Cross, or the International Red Cross, refers to as white torture is done, especially in detention, when people are detained. Now, white torture is torture, but it's, according to the Red Cross, it's not as severe as other types. Maybe some of you know more about that here than I do, but white torture would be something such as keeping food from someone for several days, or keeping them in a room that's cold, or keeping people from being able to use restroom facilities for several hours, more hours than is typical than a person would need. So different things like that are referred to as white torture, because it's not like hanging upside down or getting your head dunked underwater or something terrible, but it's still something that is not according to what we would think is a regular right of a person to be able to relieve themselves properly, eat, drink, and live in a comfortable environment. Now, later on, I think I'm going to talk about some innovations in the prison system that have been put together since 1979, but I think we're going to hold off on that. Is that right, Leo? Okay.
Jen, your turn.
Okay. I haven't ever been in a prison. And the last thing I ever thought would happen when I was going to India nearly 4 years ago would be that I would ever get involved with anything about prisons. But one of my first experiences when I went to India was to take a group of students from our international school we were working in to a city called Madurai, about 4 hours from where we were. And the purpose was to take the students from our school to what was called a reception center for children. What it turned out to be, ostensibly, was a prison for small boys. And when I say small boys, the youngest was 5 years old. And the major purpose that we could ever find out that this prison served was that the police in India are, to put it bluntly, very corrupt. And they have a quota of arrests every month. And when they get towards the end of the month and they haven't reached their quota by the means they normally might pick, of maybe picking up particularly the poor for petty theft and any other crimes that will be petty crimes but easy to pick people up on, they go out on patrol that night and will pick up children that are homeless. Which seems rather crazy to me that in a country that has 20 million homeless, without any form of shelter whatsoever, that people are jailed for sleeping on the streets. So when they find children sleeping in bus stations, in railway stations, they'll collect them and put them in this jail. Also, when we were talking to the children, several of my students were Tamil speaking, and the guards hadn't realized this, and they let us in. And they found out many stories from the children. One little boy was sitting and just sobbing hopelessly, and he had been there only 2 weeks. And his story was that he had come in from his village on a bus and was sleeping in the bus station. And because of the drought, he was hoping to earn some money to send back to his family in the village. And he had been picked up by the police and put in the jail. He wasn't able to be released unless his parents came to get him, but he couldn't let his parents know he was there. They were illiterate, he was illiterate. And he was really sobbing. Our kids actually took down his name and address and found his family and found his village, and we actually got them some money so they could go and pick him up. But he would be a very rare child that would be able to find his way back to the family. They stayed there at least 3 years, and their ages went up to about 12, 13. If they hadn't done any criminal activity before going in, they would certainly do it by the time they left, because they learnt them. When we went back another time, because we'd asked the boys what is it that they wanted, the first time we went, we took sweets and chips and a ball to play games with them, and they said, what we really want is soap, because they smelt like caged mice. They're in a concrete room that was a quarter of the size of this, and this was about 250 boys. They were never taken outside. They could look out into a walled courtyard through bars, but that was all, in a very dark room. So when we went back the next time, I went for a period of 2 years, and there were still children there 2 years later that had been there for my first visit. And I knew, because they always recognized me and came up and reminded me that I'd been there from before. But what I started to say was that the prison guards used to encourage them to steal from us. And we took soap the next time. We were trying to hand out a bar of soap to each child. And we took the paper off and scratched it all so that the guards couldn't take it back from them and resell it. Or at least it wasn't resaleable as a new bar of soap, so it might discourage them. But one guard was saying to one boy, he slipped past, and one of our students was there, have you taken as much as you can? And he showed that he had somehow, when they had so few rags on, they just literally had rags tied around their body, been able to take from us 3 bars of soap and hide them. But they were encouraged to steal. Also, they kept 2 little girls there who were to be used. And we also found out that the younger boys were used by the older boys and the prison guards. Isn't it a really nice story? It's a terrible story. There has been a Supreme Court inquiry, we found out, because the kids and I then tried to find out what could be done. And that these detention centres are supposed to be all closed down. We've written letters, and at the time I left, 3.5 years later, we had seen no change whatsoever. My other experience of prisons is mostly through reading. There's a very good magazine, if you're interested at all in the situation in India, called Manushi, and it comes out of Delhi, and it's a magazine that only survives on subscription. It has no advertising, and the stories are very well researched. They do have an outlet here in America. I don't know that, but I do have the address in India, and I think it might cost about $19 a year to subscribe to this magazine. And in it, several women were arrested. There's a story about several women who were arrested for political activity. And when they went into the jails, they found that women who had been raped were jailed for their protection. And many of the women they met had been in the jail for 12 to 17 years, waiting for something to happen. Nothing, of course, was going to happen. These were very poor women, very illiterate women who didn't know their rights, and life in the jail was very unpleasant. Because the women who were arrested knew their rights, they at least required them to regularly bring them up for what's the word I'm looking for? It's left my head.
For a hearing?
Yeah, to at least continue to keep their, the word has left me. It wasn't parole, because they were never actually went to court. Before they went to court, they have to keep bringing them up for, a renewal of why they've arrested them, what they're suspected for. So the women stayed in the jail for quite some time and started to inform these poor, illiterate women of their rights. And many of them had been there for petty crimes for 25 years and 20 years, with their whole lives destroyed, but had no idea how to get themselves out of the jails. My third experience with jails was that we became involved in issues related to the repatriated Tamils from Sri Lanka and the way that they had been maltreated by the Tamils in India and by the rest of the Indian government, apart from the maltreatment they experienced in Sri Lanka. And in working with these people, our collector, who was a little bit like a sheriff, I guess, in American terms, sub-collector, was a very honest man, and he was a Sikh. And he worked very hard to get justice for these repatriated Tamils who had been bonded laborers. And indeed, a Supreme Court inquiry did declare these people to be bonded laborers and had them released. But in doing so, it bought into a whole system of the wealthy in India who repress and have large companies repress the poor and oppress the poor. And he engendered a lot of disfavor. So the best way that he was got at was through his family. And because he was a Sikh, although he was had come from the Punjab, but living down in Tamil Nadu, his young brother came to visit him. And by what is a new act in India called the Terrorist Act that came in after Indira Gandhi's death. I can't give you specific details of dates and times because I don't have any of the literature with me to remind me. He was able to be arrested without any indictment, without any evidence, without being told specifically why he was arrested, and put in jail. And he can be put anywhere in India the government likes in jail and left there and never ever be brought up for a hearing so long as he is suspected of being a terrorist. The bit of information that was given was that he was seen to drive a particular type of car, that a terrorist was seen to have been in this particular type of vehicle. Now, you need to understand, in India there's only three types of vehicles and they're all the same shape and the same design, and it comes from 1955, and this was a new model that's only just come in. And there was few cars in India. So this brother of the Sikh drove a vehicle like this. A known terrorist, was seen to take a ride in a vehicle like that, which was enough evidence to pick this young man up and leave him in jail. His family cannot speak to him. They don't know where he is half the time. He does get moved, and they have people that will gradually let them know, but there is no evidence that he will be released. He is not being indicted, and he doesn't have to be. So there are my experiences of Indian jails.
Yeah. We should say white torture. You can drive a person crazy, you see, by just denying bathroom privileges and sleep.
I mean, thinking about what to tell you about these kinds of experiences, and it's a very hard thing to do, because first the experiences you have in prison are not very different from experience you have in real life, and it is nothing very special and nothing really different. So everybody can imagine it very, very easy. Maybe when he's in a train or something, yeah, and he can't get out for several hours or something like that, yeah. I think some people are interested in knowing about my background. I've been living in East Germany all my life, 1979, I was imprisoned, and I had a trial. It was about involvement in some escape plans of some friends of mine, and I never had a plan to escape, but I knew about the plans of friends, and I should have reported it, and not reporting was against the law, or is against the law, and that brought me a sentence of a year, and I had to serve 10 months of it. After 10 months, I was released, and they let me go then to West Germany. So since 1980, I'm living in West Germany, actually in West Berlin, and I'm a German citizen. The West German government pays for that. They pay for every prisoner, I think, between $10,000 and maybe $70,000. And there are maybe around 5,000 East German prisoners every year are set free to the West. They have the chance to decide in the prison if they whether they want to or not, but most of them go to the West then. There was nothing very special about the time in prison. The only thing that is very different, the East Germany, like all communist states, have no legal system like you know it from the free world. Yeah, prisoners have no rights at all. They are mostly held in total isolation from their family. They have no rights to write, to get visits, to have a lawyer. There aren't lawyers in usually in communist countries. They don't need lawyers in their legal system. I had a lawyer in my trial. He helped me a lot. I saw him. It took 5 months until the trial was held, and I saw him only one time in that time. And we were not allowed to talk about the case. Yeah, so it was. But it was nice to meet him, yeah, and we had a good talk, yeah. Yeah, and he helped me a lot, as much as he could do. To be a prisoner in a communist state is, I think, very different from to be a prisoner in any other part of the world. I don't talk about the third world because I don't know anything about it. First, to be a so-called political prisoner means for a communist government that you are an enemy of society at all, anyway, what you have done or not done. So the restrictions are much harder than any other prisoner has to suffer. Yeah? In most of the prisons, the political prisoners are under the hardest and worst conditions. The first 5 months I was in a prison of a secret police, because Before a political prisoner goes, has its trial, they are held in prisons of the secret police in all communist countries. And it was, very, very, very bad in a way. There was no physical torture, but there was almost no room in a very small cell where you had to stay all the time. There was no light from the outside. There was only electric light the whole day, 24 hours mostly. And you was not allowed to have any personal stuff. That is part of the concept of depersonalization, I would call it. You have not own clothes, you have no pictures, you have no writing utensils, you have no right to write anything at all. Mostly, most persons have no books and nothing to read. Sometimes they have, but strange. In every cell there's a Bible. Yeah, I think this is only in East German prisons. I don't know why, but they have a Bible everywhere, so you can read in the Bible very much. Yeah, so I know it pretty well now since then. And I was allowed, that was very special in this time, to have a hymnal, the hymnal of the Lutheran Church. And so I learned all the hymns of Martin Luther and Paul Gerhardt. I didn't meet any person who knows that much hymns like me by heart. And there were lots of funny things too going on, especially after the trial when I was brought to a correctional institution. That was not very bad, I think. You was almost only with political prisoners, very interesting persons, lots of talks and lots of ideas and lots of discussions. Yeah. Because people have very different ideas, and you can talk about it. That can take. I've been working then. Before that, there was no work, nothing at all. Yeah. So sometimes you had weeks without doing anything in that small cell. Yeah. And I think the most. The hardest problem for every prisoner is the boredom, not all the other things, because you can get used to very hard conditions very fast. And if you are in a good constitution, mainly in a psychic constitution, you can stand very hard things in your life, maybe more than only 10 months. And maybe harder conditions, and I don't think this time, this 10 months I spent in that prison, was only a bad experience or something I pity or feel very sorry about or something like that. Yeah, it was a kind of experience which was special, but was for me not that different that I would say that was a complete new thing. And that's all I want to say now about this. Okay.
But you had enough to eat.
Yeah, there was always enough to eat, and it was never a problem. Yeah.
Thanks. I was just thinking while being here, although I'm from South Africa, I've also spent a year in New York. And one of the things about a panel like this is you might start getting the ideas that prisons are something that happen in third world countries and communist countries. But the prison situation in New York City is just as bad as some of the things that have been described here. So please don't get the idea that this only happens out there in other people's countries. Okay, the South African situation. I have been in prison. I've been arrested 3 times. The first 2 occasions were, and all three times ended up in prison awaiting trial. The first 2 times only overnight, and the third time for 5 days. But I haven't been ever sentenced to time in prison, so I've always been an awaiting trial prisoner. Let me give you an idea of the 3 times I've been arrested to give you some of the kind of feel for that. The first time was doing street theater on a busy corner of a place in Claremont, which is a suburb of Cape Town, and it has a shopping center and a shopping mall. And we were doing street theater outside, and there were 6 of us, and we were arrested by about 20 or 30 policemen. And we were arrested under what is known as a riotous assembly. Not a righteous assembly, but a riotous assembly, for inciting people to riot and to have a gathering. The law in South Africa is that any group of 2 people in a public space is a gathering, and gatherings are illegal. The second time was... I'm just trying to think of the year. That first time was 1983. The second time must have been 1984 or 1985, I can't remember. A prayer service was held. There was some killings in a place called Uitenhage outside of Port Elizabeth on the east coast of South Africa. The police had opened point blank on a group of mourners at a funeral, and it killed 20 odd people. And it was on March the 21st, which is Sharpeville Day in South Africa. So it kind of had this double symbolic thing. On the same day that Sharpeville had happened in 1960, this happened in 1985. So a prayer meeting was called at a Methodist church just near the Parliament buildings of South Africa in Cape Town. And after the service, the people filed out in, I think, rows of 3 and in a long sort of march. There must have been about 500 people. And it's highly illegal to do this kind of thing, but people did it anyway. That often happens in South Africa. And we were stopped sort of round the corner by a whole team of riot police and loaded onto 3 vans. I think the final arrest number were 240 people. Included in that group were Alan Busak, Desmond Tutu, and Beyers Naudé, who had led the prayer service. On both occasions, we were fingerprinted and stamped and all those goodies that happen to you when you get arrested and put in prison, and then basically overnight, and then let out to face charges and charges. In the first case, we were found guilty and sentenced to the equivalent of $200 and 4 months suspended for 3 years. I think it's just run out. And I was actually under suspension and was arrested the second time for doing the same thing. So I'd taken that decision that I wasn't going to let that bother me. The third thing was arrested also for the same thing. One of the most important people in South African politics is a person called Nelson Mandela, who's in prison at a place called Polsmoor, which is about 20 kilometers outside the center of Cape Town. Just before the state of emergency came to the Cape Town area in 1985, because I was still in South Africa. It had been declared already in the Transvaal and in the Eastern Cape, and part of the whole call was for the release of Nelson Mandela. And a march was called the March on Polsmoor, to basically, I don't know what we thought we were going to do, but I think some people thought we were going to try and release Nelson Mandela. Others thought we were just going to deliver a letter to the warders. Others thought we were just doing it to cause trouble. And all those reasons are valid, I think. And so we were supposed to start at a football stadium, a soccer stadium, in a colored township outside Cape Town, and march about 15 kilometers. even that will let you know that nobody had the slightest hope that the march would actually succeed. But by the early morning, the police, first of all, it's illegal. Secondly, and the state of emergency was declared in Cape Town, so it became doubly illegal. And then a specific provision was made that no marches could be held on that day in South Africa. So that was triply illegal. Anyway, the people called it, and the police were there, and there was tear gas. And you may have seen some of the stuff on your TV, because in fact this was... It kind of happened in a way that the state of emergency hadn't really happened, and anyway. But we started marching, and then the police stopped us, and we refused to move, so they attacked us with batons and tear gas canisters and all that. If you're ever in South Africa, and you're ever in a march, and you ever get attacked by policemen wielding whips and tear gas and all that, the safest thing is to actually keep walking forward. For some strange reason, it's police tactics to hit those people who are running away on the back and on the head. But if you actually face them and stay where you are, for some strange reason, you get arrested instead. So we were arrested for that. There were about 36 of us, a mixed race group. And then we were in prison for 5 days as they argued whether we were allowed bail or not. And the government basically argued for 5 days that we shouldn't be allowed bail, on the grounds that we were the chief instigators of all the problems in Cape Town. Anyway. And then they actually withdrew their own case once things had quietened down. So it was an attempt to basically detain us for 5 days because they reckoned they had the leadership there, which wasn't really the case because there were a couple of nuns and priests and ministers and students and one or two people who got picked up for fun. So those have been my experiences. Inside prison, it's no great shakes in South Africa if you're white. Prisons are racially segregated, white and black. White prisoners have it pretty easy. The time I was in, we were all in separate cells. Unlike black people who were arrested in exactly the same place and taken in exactly the same police van. But they, in fact, had more fun because they were all together in the same cell. So they organized worship services and seminars and discussion groups and all. The one thing that we discovered is that, do you know the game Battleships, where you place your little ships in squares? Well, if you ever think about it, that's the one game that you can play in prison when you're in a cell by yourself and somebody else is in a separate cell. So many other games require the fact that you need to see the same board, but that's the one game where you're not allowed to see your opponent's board. So I think Martin mentioned that there's fun in it. I mean, it's not funny, but if you're the kind of person that gets yourself into that sort of trouble, you generally have got the kinds of resources to deal with it once you're in. And that is different for white people. The other six people, whites, men who were arrested with me, because of course men and women are separated, were all clergy people, and they all had dog collars on. And somebody remarked that as I marched down the aisle, the corridor, with these six people all with dog collars on, one of the prisoners there said in Afrikaans something to the effect of, gosh, he looks like he's going to the gallows. Because in South Africa, I don't know if it happens here, but clergy people always accompany the prisoner off to be hanged, to say the last rites, so it looked like him. But I just wanted to finish off by saying that prison is a real reality of South Africa. It's symbolized by people like Nelson Mandela and other African National Congress people who are in prison. But it's also become a really important tool from the South African government's side to be able to prison without trial, to detain people. And at present, there are more than 35,000 people in detention in South Africa. I think 15,000 of whom are under the age of 18. So 15,000 under the age of 18 in detention. So much so that, in fact, people have started using the words like a children's war in South Africa. It's one of the things I believe that makes it very difficult for Gandhi-like or Martin Luther King-like activities to take place in South Africa, in the sense that South Africa has an infinite amount of space in which to detain people, and you can simply disappear off the face of the earth. So prison is a real reality, but out of prison and that there's come a tremendous strong culture and songs and prayers and hymns. And I often wonder if we haven't ever really begun to tap a prison theology, in the sense that people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, etc., have all been in prison and have given us so much. And I wonder if that's going to happen out of South Africa some days.
Yeah, certainly in among the political prisoners. Thanks, each of you. Now, I'll just briefly summarize mine. I was in a different situation. I was in the combat infantry and made the initial landings in Africa and reserve in Tunisia, assault on Sicily. Yes, I can. I was in the armed forces in the big war, World War II, and I was in Patton's forces when we landed in Africa, and I was with the group that took Casablanca. Reserve in Tunisia for the Africa Corps mop-up, and then assault on Sicily, and then in reserve at Salerno in Italy, and then in the assault on Anzio, which was not a good place to be. It was a very bad operation, and I was on the first breakthrough, and I broke through further than almost anybody else. I got 5 miles behind the lines and never got back. So I helped win the war by not being in it, I guess. So I spent a good deal of time in Italy, southern Germany, Polish quarter, northern Germany, southwestern Germany. And Martin said that, you know, it wasn't all that bad, you know, from what you're used to. In my situation, it was a lot different. I think part of it is, maybe you, Martin, probably knew that you had a specific sentence and could depend on it. Could you? Yeah. You see, it all depends on the security of the situation. My term was not fixed. In fact, I never expected to be captured, although I was like Anzio, on landing at Anzio, I was H plus 3 minutes. That means 3 minutes behind the first troops. There isn't much to choose from in that. So you're in the thick of things. I never, as I say, expect to be captured. I was certainly killed or wounded. And I'd been fighting quite a while. So this came as a great shock to me. But I really didn't expect to make it. Because it is a very insecure kind of position, and of course we were bombed and strafed a lot, and some people didn't, of course, make it. Or when we were marched for 300 or 400 miles, part of it in a Polish winter out of Poland, that was quite difficult. We also, and the Germans had some of the same problem. They were short of rations, and if they were short of rations, a lot of times we were even short of rations. So you learn how to what hunger is. I don't know how many of you have been really hungry, but it isn't like being short of food for just a few days or a week. But that's all you think about. You could blindfold me, and you could take me into a lot of prisons, and all I had to do was sit there 5 minutes, and I can tell you whether they're hungry or not, because about what they're talking about. If you're really hungry, that's all you talk about. It's all you think about, too, almost. The hazard of being denied food, and you really have to fight it, because it gets so it's easier to give up than to keep hanging in there, because you get weak and you've got to really help each other. You have to organize under these circumstances. I don't know why I'm telling you this. I hope you'll never have to do it, but maybe some of you might be involved. But you meant, you know, to be separated like you are, that's a bad deal. You know? Fortunately, I was never in isolation. I did a few things on my own and got in some trouble with it. In fact, almost lost my life one night. But you have to form groups and help each other. You have to form true community. My particular community, when we were marched out of Poland in the middle of winter in January of 45, there was a group that referred to as Busted Terrible Ten. I happened to be the senior officer in the group, although not the oldest one. And it finally dwindled down to about six. But we were in it together, and we'd make it or not. And we organized stealing parties and everything. You see, what happened to us, and I've seen it also in prisons here, because I'm very interested in our prison system here in the United States, and as Steve indicated, it's bad news. It's very bad news. I lost my trend of thought. Oh, stealing, yes. You turn your mind clear around. When you're a prisoner, as I was, you know, how am I going to get these guys, you know? And you reverse your thinking on how you're going to beat them out of something all the time, and how you're going to hide whatever you find. We had, even though we were in a prison with very close surveillance, we had a fantastic tunnel, and we had access to a lot of stuff. We were in communication. I mean, we had a radio receiver, and we knew what was going on, and there were a lot of other things that I can't tell you. But I was also in one prison in southern Germany, where I was the underground black market person. Yeah, you always get a black market going to undermine the forces, and they're the enemy. And so you lay awake at night thinking about a complete reverse psychology, you see. And it's an interesting kind of outlook. But I've also seen this in prisons here. And as you mentioned, you know, this is a very enlightening experience, as all adversity is. With adversity, it's a very hard taskmaster. But if I had not been hungry, I mean really hungry, I probably wouldn't be as concerned about bread for the world as I am. I probably wouldn't. Like the other 100 appeals that come in my mailbox every week, and probably go down the deep six. Or I wouldn't be working with Amnesty International. I wouldn't be working with prisoners here in the United States. And a lot of other things. That's what adversity, that's how you have to respond to adversity. But the other thing about it, and I wouldn't be teaching holocausts as I am now in my course in Reverence for Life, which I've given in many institutions, because we of all times, we need some reverence for life, and one of the things we discuss are holocausts that continue. They're continuing in many, many countries. In my generation has taken more lives than any other. Mass genocide doesn't shake us anymore. And we've seen it in the recent past. In my time in Germany, there were 6 million Jews and a lot of other people whose lives were wiped out in the most, probably the most fantastically well-organized system of extermination ever conceived and implemented. And it's important that people realize that. We must continue to teach what happened, not only there, but it's happening in Afghanistan, among the Eritreans, and in Ethiopia, and Afghanistan, and in South and Central America. And we did it to the Native Americans and done it to some other people. So it's not exclusively in the confines of any one nation. Down in Southeast Asia, it's terrible what has happened. And in my mind's eye, I can see this person today as if I saw him only today, but I saw him in April of 1945 when he came to our prison in southern Germany. He was from one of the death camps. He was dead but didn't have sense enough to lay down. I'll never wipe him out of my mind. And when you've seen that, it stays with you and should move you to action. Now, I'm involved in Amnesty International, which is an organization that you should look into that makes appeals to working very much in South Africa, South America, and throughout the world, and I keep up on who's doing what to whom. I talked about Amnesty International here many years ago and told about some of the methods of torture, and some people couldn't stand it. So I'm not going to repeat that. Some people walked out because they couldn't stand it. But that kind of torture that would make you sick still goes on. Now, the other thing that we're doing, and I'll tell you more about it on Friday night when I come back in here, that is what we're doing for prisoners with animals. And I have an international committee that's working on this, of animals in prison. Has a remarkable effect on, they don't do it in political prisons, but in our prison system here in the Western world, such as when I tried to do it at Canningvale Prison, which is one of the most modern prisons in the world in Western Australia. And we're doing it here in this state and in many places in this nation, in England, with people working with animals. Has had a remarkable effect on these animals. But I'm going to tell you that later, because I want you to tell about what's happening, you know, some good things happening.
Yeah, just I would urge people to listen to that talk, actually, because it was one thing that Leo talked about last week in a talk, and it wasn't even the focus of your talk. It was about animals and animal therapy, but just about all the different ways prisoners were being used to train the animals was really an exciting thing to hear, because I think for the most part, you know, when Martin was saying that one of the worst parts of being in prison was the boredom, and to feel useful and to be helpful to society, even though incarcerated, I think is a wonderful thing. What, just briefly, one program or a couple programs that we saw while we were in Nicaragua, which were really exciting, was that people were trying to, or the penal system was trying to put people back or prepare them for life back in society. And so there were numbers and numbers of different work programs, especially farming programs. And the prisoners would work during the day out in the farm. These were only the ones that wanted to. Some chose not to and never did. But for those who desired to, they lived in special farms where they worked during the day and then had classes during the night, for example, literacy classes. They had, I can't think of the word, what do you call it when you get to, your wife can come and stay for, it starts with a C. Some sort of visits. Conjugal visits, and actually visits out to be with their families, and then we have to come back. And at one prison, actually, that I visited, and quite a few were like this, they got to the point where they had no guards. The prisoners just ran it. And people would always say, well, why don't they escape? And they said, well, our country is a small country, and if you'd escape, it'd be pretty easy to find you. You'd go home, and everyone would know where you were, and they'd pick you up. And so people realized that once they were able to work on these farms, that usually their sentences would be cut drastically. I know people that their sentences were 30 years, but they were cut down to 5 or 6 years, and they were out free, and they had talked to us. So I think there can be exciting programs, and we will talk about them, but it doesn't have to be as terrible as some of the things we've mentioned here. As far as torture, especially. Now, I agree with Leo, white torture, unquote, is not a good thing. But in Nicaragua, it's not like food deprivation goes on for days. It would be maybe, your food would be maybe 6 hours late, but then it would still come and you'd get food. Where in El Salvador, I know the different types of torture used were really, really terrible, such as, I kind of feel like Leo, I hate to go into it, some of the detailed things that I've heard, but extremely excruciating as far as pain and torture. And also in El Salvador, there is a law that the families have to find out, I think it's 14 days after you're picked up, and the International Red Cross has to be informed, and that often, most of the times, people said that never happened. People just didn't get found out. And again, a lot of times people didn't make it to the prisons because they were picked up and then later found dead in El Salvador. And so for the most part, the prison isn't the issue, it's the disappeared, as they call it.
Well, I think, of course, you do under these circumstances among the authorities, you do things that leaves no lesion, see? Leaves no lesion so that investigations later, see, you can't really tell a lesion from shock methods, denying sleep, or other privileges. But some of these, it scars you for life. I mean, even, and I can think of some of these terrible things that happen to these people. For me, I still have... sometimes wake up in terror, and it's so it's you're permanently scarred by these kind of things. So it's bad news, and it requires. I think it's important, and the reason for this is sensitization, to raise your level of sensitivity regarding this. That there's some very bad things going on, and that there are some things we can do about it. And we must not only pray about it, but do something about it.